Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Filmed in Canada, a podcast about Canadian movies. I'm Alexander Cairns, and William is not here today, but we do have a very special guest in the form of Mr. Nathan Douglas. Nathan, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, Filmed in Canada people. My name's Nathan, as Alexander said, and I am a writer and director and sometimes producer based out of Vancouver.
Nice. Yeah, we've been talking about doing a podcast for a while, at least since your film premiered at VIFF last year. That was Cave of Sighs. If anyone happened to catch that last year, I don't know how many people listening are actually from Vancouver or other parts of Canada or other parts of the world, but definitely a few people listening in from Vancouver that hopefully saw your short last year.
I hope so. Yeah.
Those short programs were pretty great, and I don't know who was programming them. Maybe you could offer some insights there, but really wide variety of things to see and lots of interesting voices to be heard out of the local Vancouver area here. Although I guess they weren't all Vancouver centric, but I guess a good majority of them were.
Yeah, the VIFF shorts are always a mix. They're typically, well, there's international shorts, but that's a totally separate category. So the programs that you're speaking of are the Canadian shorts, and those are all programmed. Last year, they were all programmed by Curtis Wallachuk. And he's been basically doing that for the last few years at VIFF, and he's been doing an incredible job shining a light on kind of new Canadian cinema that's coming up through the short film ranks.
Yeah, so, and that's typically how things start gestating and hopefully building into bigger and better things.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you... I think historically short films have, you know, amongst institutions that are searching for what's new, what's coming up, short films are the format that allows you to see those new ideas. They're usually, you know, not too expensive to make depending on your ambitions, and you can play with ideas. There's much more opportunity to take risks, to try things. And usually sometimes, in I think the fear in a lot of filmmakers' careers is that, you know, the only time they will really get to play and really get to try something without, you know, a lot of problems per se, like trying to take risks and try something different. Like short films are the only real opportunity for that, depending on who you're working with, I guess. But, yeah, it's, I would say as a Canadian filmmaker, you know, when I go to look at short films, you know, I love watching them. I love seeing, yeah, what else is happening in the rest of the country to get a sense, and even just to see like the regional differences in some ways. What are the concerns in different areas that, you know, other young filmmakers are concerned about? And it's a vital lifeline, really, for Canadian cinema culture. It kind of starts with short films in some ways, you know, because feature making is so kind of boxed in a lot of the time institutionally in this country. Short films are kind of the things that can breathe.
Nice. Well, we'll talk about a few of your shorts in more detail, as well as just kind of what you're seeing out there and what's caught your interest and that sort of thing in terms of other filmmakers maybe or wherever that goes. But I guess what we wanted to start with was a discussion of the French-Canadian film Jesus of Montreal, Jésus de Montréal. I typically try to avoid obnoxiously inserting French into my dialect.
It's a very bad habit of mine. I put them in my films too.
Yeah, but yeah, where to start there? I mean, it's sort of considered a classic of Canadian cinema. I guess you saw it at the Canada Day series that the Cinematheque was running. I had seen it a number of years ago and then rewatched it at home in preparation for this. But I guess maybe start with why you wanted to talk about it when I approached you to come on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it took quite a while for me. My relationship with Canadian cinema is and probably like a number of people, is you know, it's had its real ups and downs. It's something that I certainly didn't get an education in growing up, you know, in the school. I grew up in Ontario, and I think this is probably standard for most of English Canada, if not all, but, you know, getting acquainted with Canadian cinema, especially, you know, whether it's Quebecois or English Canadian cinema, is not something that's part of your, you know, your typical public education. So I kind of carried around that stigma for a long time of, you know, Canadian cinema is this thing that is boxed in and it is not interesting to me. It wasn't until really studying it in university that kind of was broken. But at the same time, some of those studies did confirm some of those suspicions, and there's definitely trends and things within the history of Canadian cinema that we are still struggling to overcome. Mm-hmm. Some of them are like external to the art form itself, economic concerns, population concerns, you know, being able to support this sort of public art form mm-hmm. is very difficult for Canada, especially English Canada. But there is such a vast wealth of potential, you know, in terms of talent, in terms of experiences that for people to draw on. Mm-hmm. And when I say all that as a preamble, that Jesus of Montreal for me, even with kind of having, you know, when I was studying at university, the experience of realizing Canadian cinema isn't, you know, is very interesting and does have a lot of merit to it. You know, for me personally, I still don't quite connect to it the way I do to, like, you know, other forms, other foreign cinemas, certain directors from other countries that just speak much more directly to my spirit and what I'm looking for in a great work of art. Mm-hmm. So I suggested, yeah, Jesus of Montreal because, you know, I'm very interested in the sort of intersection of spirituality, you know, the elements of religious faith, and cinema, and, you know, that can take many forms in different, you know, in how filmmakers approach that. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I find in Canadian cinema, even now, I don't know too much about how this history in terms of Quebecois cinema and Quebec being such a, you know, formerly extremely Catholic, society. I don't know the history exactly of how they've engaged with that, but Jesus of Montreal certainly seems like a major sort of, intersection of a lot of those things. So for me, I picked it because it is a Canadian film that is probing these religious and historical questions and doing so in a very, I think, kind of a somewhat of a personally motivated way. It's not purely kind of an intellectual exercise,
right?
Which I think we'll unpack as we go along.
So I guess just sort of starting off with a general synopsis, the film opens with a play performance. I don't. Do you know what the play was?
I don't.
Yeah.
I actually looked it up afterwards and I can't remember.
Okay. So it starts with the performance. They go backstage. And there's an actor that doesn't really appear in the rest of the film, but mm-hmm. he sees someone who he hasn't seen in a long time. This gentleman, Daniel Coulombe, who in the following scene ends up going to coming into contact with a priest in some way. I can't remember if he goes to the church or if the priest approaches him. Or
I think the implication is that he answered an ad. You know, he was basically going to a job interview.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he arrives at the church and the priest wants him to put on this play, which is just kind of a historical recounting of the life of Jesus Christ in a way.
It's a traditional, it's around, you know, during the season of Lent in the Catholic Church, and in other churches as well. But particularly since this is the story is set in a Catholic society, it's the Stations of the Cross. So it's not quite a, you know, it's a liturgical play in a sense. Like it is supposed to be a series of prayers, basically meditations. It's a meditation basically. Where the faithful will go from station to station and they'll meditate on whatever the station's subject is. So it's not strictly a play. It's not just for, kind of like entertainment and people pay whatever, but it is play as prayer. And there's a very, you know, long tradition of that going back to at least medieval times.
Okay.
In the church.
So he gets tasked with directing this play,
passion
or
play,
this prayer
essentially.
Play. Okay. So passion play is the short term the shorthand that they use throughout. And he goes about kind of hiring his troupe, and then they put on the performance of the passion play. But I guess there are a few elements that are not looked kindly upon by the higher ups in the church. I don't know the technical terms, maybe,
obviously. Hierarchy, you could say. Yeah.
And so that sort of sets up this conflict of, you know, will they be able to continue to perform it or not? And I guess that conflict, in a way, kind of turns itself into perhaps a religious metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
As the main character, Daniel, kind of ends up becoming this Christ-like presence in Montreal society, kind of
thing. Yeah, are we going to go all the way into spoilers, or
not immediately? But
okay, yeah.
We kind of gradually get there.
Yeah,
and with the caveat that, you know, if you want to see the movie, go see the movie. Don't listen to us to determine whether or not you want to see it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
maybe just like general thoughts.
Yeah.
Coming away from it.
Well, so the film was, I actually didn't really know what, I didn't do any reading up on it when I went into it. So I kind of was just wanted to go in totally fresh and just let it hit me. And I was surprised. It was more schematic. It was more metaphorical than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of more, you know, kind of clinical in that sense. I think it is so in an amusing way. A way that is interesting for sure. Mm-hmm. It didn't quite reach me at the deepest level of sort of, you know, what I look for in a film dealing with sort of that subject matter. Mm-hmm. But I think that is one of the interesting things about it, actually, in that it is a very seems to me, as an outsider from Quebec cinema and Quebec culture, Quebecois culture, that it is a very Quebec film in dealing with the, you know, basically the weight and the memory, the burden of kind of Quebec's very Catholic history.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that, you know, here we are almost 30 years after Jesus of Montreal. And it's very, it is interesting to see it as a snapshot, even not so much even of Quebec, but even just certain ideas that were floating around in Christian thinking, you know, in that time. I don't know about Denis Arcand, if he is, I'm assuming he's not a practicing Christian, but I don't know for sure. Or even if he would consider himself maybe like a liberal Christian, in terms of, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, but especially in the 80s, there was, you know, a lot of movement amongst kind of liberal theologians, and this sort of this attempted historical deconstruction of the Bible and of, you know, Christian tradition, history. And, you know, there's the Jesus Seminar, which was kind of about dismantling the divinity of Jesus and trying to understand him purely as a man from a sort of a secular viewpoint. And it's interesting to see a lot of those ideas are kind of certainly influencing Jesus of Montreal.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess the main conflict that the church has with the with the presentation of this passion play is that they portray Jesus as the son of a Roman soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And that that Mary was like gave actual birth, not like virgin birth.
Well, that she was impregnated by a man, and
right,
in the natural way, and was, you know, like basically contrary to the Christian teaching of the virgin birth and
right,
so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess for me watching it, I guess that's an interesting point that you bring up in terms of whether or not Mr. Arcand is a practicing Christian or whether he was at some point or not. Maybe that's something that we can go back and do some more research into at a later date, but watching it, I don't get the sense that he is.
Yeah, me neither.
And
not
about. I don't. It doesn't feel like he feels any need to present a purely religious or purely devout perspective in the film. If I can recall correctly, the only few characters that actually are openly Catholic in any way are the priest character, who's like not a very good priest.
Yep.
And then the two the two audience members that come up to them after one of the performances and are basically just completely crazy and talking about these conspiracies.
The sycophant.
And how you know, credit card companies are inserting the number of the beast and all this nonsense. And so it doesn't really seem like he has much respect for people of faith.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess I feel like, I don't know if I could say he doesn't have respect. It's certainly, I wouldn't blame anyone for drawing that distinction, but I feel like there were opportunities where someone who really had it out for people of faith, I think he pulled some punches that other directors would have let loose on. I think the priest character is a great.
He didn't go to the full extent of admonishing the church, or
either he felt he didn't need to, and maybe this is because it is a film in Quebec, and everyone in Quebec kind of already gets the whole, you know, the tensions that he's exploring in the society. Mm-hmm. But I get the sense that here's the thing. I don't think Arcand is a believer at all. But what I did appreciate about his take on the film, and just for clarification, I am a Roman Catholic. I actually converted to the faith 4 or 5 years ago, and was received in the church 4 years ago. So for me, a lot of this is still very. I am a believer, a lot of this is very fresh and new for me still.
Yeah.
But so from that perspective, I appreciate Arcand's sense of. Typology in a sense, but by that I mean, you know, one way of reading scripture is you look at the Old Testament and you look at the different stories in the Old Testament of the people of Israel and so forth, and different people who you know, were there, and a lot of these stories, like, we believe they were collected in the Old Testament to kind of serve as hints and prefiguring of things that Jesus would do later on during his ministry on earth. And so one example would be probably the best example really that most people would be familiar with is the Israelites being brought out of Egypt. You know, Moses was chosen to lead them out of Egypt by God, and then they crossed the Red Sea. So the early Christians looked at that and they saw that as a prefigurement of what Jesus Christ did for mankind, the entire human race, on the cross, wherein, you know, the Israelites were physically freed from physical bondage, traveled, you know, they crossed the Red Sea in this kind of cleansing, this kind of baptism, and then they ended up in the desert, wandered for 40 years, and finally came to the Promised Land. And early Christians looked at that and they said, hey, that's us, but, you know, that prefigures what is happening to us spiritually, which is, you know, Jesus brought us out of bondage of our sins, out of our own Egypts, through baptism, which is the first sacrament that anyone receives when they become a Christian. Through baptism of water, we are cleansed of our old ways and moved into the new life. And then, you know, at the end of our lives, if we persevere, there is heaven, the Promised Land. And so that's just one example. But how that relates to Jesus of Montreal, what he does with the, you know, the entire framing story of Jesus of Montreal is this, you know, it's kind of a mirror narrative of Jesus and the apostles.
That's one thing that I was hoping that you could provide more insight on, because I'm ignorant to a lot of the stories of the Bible and that. So I wasn't really able to pick up on any parallels or anything like that.
Yeah. So for example, one you mentioned at the very beginning of the film, there's this tossed off beginning with the play that we never hear about again, and the actor and these sort of sycophant people come up to this actor.
Sorry, what is sycophant?
Sorry, sycophants, like they're like sucking up to him, and they're like, okay, really just like, you're amazing. Because all throughout the film, they go up to different actors and they go, you're incredible. You need to be in this. You're awesome. They just say the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm. I'd say the best extension of that sort of concept was the two, the radio broadcaster and the television people. Like, they're both presenting this idea of who Danielle is, but they're completely conflicting.
Yes.
And I would presume that has something to do with, I think that's how Jesus was portrayed.
It's a play, I think, on the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the two sort of schools of Jewish rabbinic thought. I believe it had to do with the resurrection of the dead, essentially. Yeah. One school of thought believed that, you know, everyone's body would be resurrected at the end of time, and the other one didn't, or they had a variation on that. And so, but they were both part of the, you know, the religious establishment that Jesus was challenging. They were both trying to trip him up. but they also, you know, politically, if he proved, you know, useful for them, then they would have tried to spin him, you know, however, and you could say from a purely political perspective, when they failed, when they finally realized that he wasn't going to be able to be spun for anybody, you know, then that's when they decided they would need to kill him.
Yeah.
That's just speculation. That's not strictly from scripture. But the with these characters at the beginning, so they go up to this this actor who we see in the play, and they say, "You're so amazing." And then he says, no, that guy over there, he's a real actor. And he points to Daniel, who of course is playing Jesus.
Right.
And you know, this is a direct allusion to John the Baptist, who early in the Gospels is, you know, he was sent to prepare the way for the Messiah. And he was Jesus's cousin as well, actually, by blood. Mm-hmm. And so when he would baptize the people of Israel in the River Jordan, and they would come to him and in order to repent of their sins. And, you know, he was within a long line of prophets who would come to Israel periodically, sent by God to remind them of their holy, you know, their holy destiny as a nation, their holy priesthood as a nation, and call them back to who they are. And, but then when, you know, people went to John the Baptist and they said, "Hey, who is, are you the Messiah?" And he said, no, there's another one coming who is greater than I am. Mm-hmm. And so that right from the beginning, like the very first scene, you know, Arcand is playing with this. And so because of the way he plays with that, there's a couple of really great scenes in the film that riff off that. And one is the temptation of Jesus. There's that scene in the high rise, where the network, the television producer is, you know, basically looking out over Montreal with him. And he says,
he's a lawyer,
the lawyer. That's right.
But he claims to kind of,
but he's got his fingers in all these different, in all these different areas. Right.
Yeah.
And he's basically tempting Jesus with like, well, we could brand you this way. We could sell this sort of thing. We could have a show. We could do this, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Books, the book thing.
Yeah.
And I love,
but he says we can, like, you can have a book, but he's like, "Oh, I'm not a writer." And he's like, "Oh, that's fine.
Doesn't matter.
You can just have your name."
We have writers.
Yeah.
But what I love about that is that they actually, I think that's my favorite scene in the film, because formally, the way that Arcand like films that, I think it's in one take, essentially. Yeah. Going down this long corridor with the glass on one side, the city of Montreal.
Yeah, he might cut once it gets to the
end.
The viewpoint.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking out on the city.
But it's a really canny piece of staging, because it just allows the moment to build and to build and to sort of see. It's a very sly, in some ways, I think, you know, like replaying of essentially Satan's temptation of Jesus as depicted in the Gospels, wherein he tempted him with first his hunger, because Jesus was fasting. So the devil said, turn these stones into bread. And then the second temptation was, you know, I will, throw yourself down from the temple mount and the angels will catch you. And that's a temptation to like just, you know, basically just, I don't know, abuse the faithfulness of God in a sense. Like, it's a very impetuous thing to do, right? The third thing was, bow down to me and I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth. So you see this playing out in this scene. It's a very canny piece of writing and how it recontextualizes all of that for a modern audience. And there are other parts in the film that I think are a little, you know, more on the nose with how they replay scriptural passages it doesn't quite reach that level of depth that I was kind of hoping it would, drawing on that material. Mm-hmm. But that scene in the skyscraper, especially formally, like, I think it really achieves probably the peak of the film for allowing those moments to build. One of my complaints about the film related to this is that a lot of it, like a lot of North American cinema, is, you know, in terms of moment to moment shooting, editing, you know, it's all very solid. It's very solid craftsmanship, but it's also kind of got this very flat, prosaic feeling to it, you know, as opposed to every single shot, you know, kind of is a poem unto itself, or is a story unto itself. You know, you kind of, you're, I mean, it's very standard. It's the standard mode of Western cinema, right?
Yeah.
Especially North American. Excuse me. That, you know, narrative continuity requires this form of staging, blocking and shooting and intercutting.
Right.
And, yeah, I guess for me as an English Canadian filmmaker, one of the things, you know, having an influence like Quebec cinema in Canada, you know, amongst many levels, not just cinema, but it kind of gives this, you know, I think a very valuable old world, I guess you could say, this valuable European, more European kind of injection into Canadian culture. Mm-hmm. I think one that is, yeah, it has deeper roots than a lot of English Canada. It has more potential, I think, for a richer kind of understanding of at least day-to-day life. And also things like, of course, like religion and all that. But a lot of Canadian films, Quebecois or English Canadian, you know, they are prosaic, just like a lot of the American counterparts or British counterparts. Like, you know, it is pretty rare to find someone trying to make a film like a Japanese master or like one of the French New Wave masters or something.
Right.
So I know that's a bit of a tall order, but I guess when the subject matter, I think, requires a certain meditation, and, you know, I think Jesus of Montreal does kind of approach that in some ways, but I think formally I would have preferred it to be a little bit more, meditative, a little bit slower, a little bit more subdued.
Yeah.
But I think
even I'm just thinking of some of the interactions where members of the audience interrupt the performance or the police show up or these kinds of things. It kind of, it interrupts your ability to interact with the ideas that are going on in the passion play.
Yeah. These very narrative, like, okay, we got to move the plot forward.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. So it does feel a bit to me like a freight train, as a lot of films do. Mm-hmm. And I think it is more stark when you have subject matter that is more conducive towards meditation, that you kind of want to turn it over and just sit with it for a while. Cause then of course we end up with the conclusion of Daniel's fate, essentially, where he is, you know, he undergoes his own passion, his own torture, and eventually dies mm-hmm. in a subway, on a subway platform. And, it just kind of has to get to that, you know, they kind of, I guess this is where you kind of see the pitfalls in some ways of trying to make an allegory, you know, or trying to stick to the allegory too closely.
Right.
That you kind of have, okay, we have, you know, he's this Christ figure within the story about Christ. And yeah, the film is very self-aware about, again, in that sort of late modern, or I guess maybe it's early postmodern, but in that climate that it was made in the late 80s, you know, this very, very self-aware kind of leftist Christian milieu of, okay, we don't believe in the divinity of Jesus, but we believe he was a real guy, and we're just going to try to understand him as a human being, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I would say that is a dead end. You fundamentally cannot understand Jesus unless you approach him in his divinity as well as his humanity.
Right.
But the film, it's interesting that the film sort of tries to go down some of these alleyways, but then it's still
sort of overwhelmed by its need to kind of,
I don't think it's overwhelmed.
Pin a needle in them or deflate them or critique them or satirize them in some way.
Yeah. It's like, I think the satirizing, yeah, that is key. Like the satire is all over the place.
Yeah.
And it is definitely satirizing elements of Quebec culture of that time, that things that I don't quite understand, but like with the television people and the stuff, like, I mean, but it's,
yeah, I got the sense that those commercials were very specific riffs on well-known advertisements or anything like that.
Yeah, that's what I assume too. And even the TV, the news anchor or whatever, who there's that moment where the news anchor is going to a cut, basically. They're going to the commercial break, and then we stay with them.
Yeah.
I really like that, though.
But also when they switched to the secondary camera, she kind of held for a second looking at the first one, and then like saw that they, I guess the producer didn't signal properly that she should turn her head or whatever.
I was reading a comment on Letterboxd actually that highlighted this, and I thought it was good. I'm trying to remember what they said exactly, but they say basically they love that he waited that long. And I agree with them as far as, yeah, like instead of cutting, that this person was writing, saying like, instead of cutting away when she says, let's go to the commercial break, cutting away like any other director would have, he stayed with them to kind of just drive home. I think just drive home the absurdity of like the forced performance, you know, the nature of what this kind of like modern media requires of us, and the way that it's dictated by sort of these technological, you know, it's kind of like trains in a sense, like, right. Yeah. Like everything's on the rails. It's going to keep going. And to be a broadcaster, you have to, you have to fit into that, right?
Yeah.
And it also requires, yeah, like they need this many seconds to make the cut properly. You have to hold that pose.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do like that he's kind of working with that. He's kind of working with the weirdness of performing.
Yeah.
You know, in a modern media saturated society.
Yeah. Speaking of performance, I guess like for me watching it, it feels like the like he's making a comparison between the act of performing in front of an audience and Jesus.
Yeah.
to put it bluntly.
Yeah, but, it's right there.
Yeah, and I don't know, I found that kind of like, and I, like, I'm not a religious person in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that felt like that was just kind of disrespectful.
Yeah, well, I think a Quebec, a faithful, pious Quebec audience member would have seen. I mean, the film, I think they would have read the film as blasphemous. I mean, I'm a practicing Catholic. I love the faith, every fiber of my being. I don't know if I think there are elements that are blasphemous about it. Sorry, just to clarify, blasphemy is a term that gets thrown around a lot, and a lot of people sometimes confuse what it actually means, but essentially means profaning things that are reserved for, like, for belief, things that are holy. So like, yeah, in a certain sense, like taking God's name in vain is a blasphemy.
Mm-hmm.
Saying a swear word, you know, is that doesn't involve the name of God or his mother or something that is, you know, associated with Christ, the Trinity, you know, just saying like a swear word, like, you know, that is that's a profanity. So it's not, you know, it's not the same like blasphemy. This probably doesn't mean anything to anyone who's not religious, but for people who are religious, it is actually there's a distinction, you know, in terms of comporting oneself with language. You know, when I hear our Lord's name being taken in vain, it's much more of a violent, I have much more of a violent, visceral response inside me to that because of what it is, kind of, it's very damaging to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It can also go in the realm of like kind of ideas and playing loose with things that, you know, from a Christian perspective are entirely, you know, this is the faith. This is what happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, and yeah, I believe, in what the Gospels teach and what happened, you know, historically speaking, everything. So to watch Jesus of Montreal, like I know I go in aware that he's not coming at it from that perspective. Even this, the very, like this whole idea of this passion play that is essentially like a, you know, it is this kind of modern liberal take on the passion play. It's mm-hmm. again, the film is very self-aware about the politics of that with the priest who protests, and the priest essentially doesn't care, but he...
Well, and his only reason for protest is because he'll get in trouble.
Exactly.
Or he'll be seen, yeah, poorly as a result of it, or he would lose his position in the church or whatever. He doesn't really seem to care about it from a perspective of protecting the Bible.
Which, it's interesting, if this film was made two generations earlier, maybe one generation earlier, you know, that would have been probably even way more scandalous and upsetting than when he did make it. And I think that's actually one of the best points of his critique. I say this as a Christian. The priest character it's funny that it takes someone kind of from a secular culture in order to point this out, because there are something the church has struggled with for years. Of course, there are many, many priests who have essentially betrayed the teaching of the faith. You know, for them, it's just a career or it's a means of power,
mm-hmm.
And staying actually true to what the faith teaches. You know, it's a struggle for anybody, but and priests under a lot of pressure, of course. But I think this is where the sort of the element of like this could only really happen in Quebec, this particular way, mm-hmm. because of the way that priests carried so much authority previously in the culture. But also, you know, to sort of look at the history of the hierarchy, the bishops of Quebec and even across Canada, you know, from the 1960s onwards, the bishops of Canada up until maybe, you know, the 90s, maybe even early 2000s, there was this kind of, you know, really lukewarm response to like, what does it mean to be a Catholic? What does it mean to be a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to live the faith? You know, the bishops were not there leading us in what it means to be that. They just kind of, you know, tended, you know, the finances or tried to, you know, make things more palatable to sort of a modern liberal audience, tried to water things down,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you essentially can't water down. This is the great tension, of course, in the modern church, you know, between kind of, do we really believe what we say we believe, or, you know, do we actually believe something else? Mm-hmm. I'm getting a little bit far afield here, but what I'm trying to say with the priest, it's a brilliant critique of that particular kind of cleric who I imagine, I've been to Quebec a few times. I've, you know, been to mass and like, you know, this is pretty widespread across a lot of the Western world, but in Quebec in particular, like I don't walk into any parish in Quebec expecting like a beautiful liturgy or expecting to hear, I mean, I can't understand French fluently, but
right.
I wouldn't expect to hear a great homily either, you know, just kind of looking at the history of, and even just the way, you know, kind of the faith has left the hearts of people. Not everybody, there's always a remnant, but
yeah.
You can kind of see, I think it's pretty obvious if you look at kind of, you look around you when you're there, like something is very, very wrong here.
Yeah.
And the priest character in the film is kind of a summary of that, you know, someone who is expedient only to just save his own skin. He's having an affair on the side. It's funny that the idea of the fallen priest is a very typical literary character,
mm-hmm.
you know, going back to like, well, probably even like Canterbury Tales or something, but like you have Graham Greene's famous priest in the Power and the Glory, who fathers an illegitimate child. He's an alcoholic and he's the last priest in Mexico being hunted by the secular authorities in the 1920s and 30s.
Right.
And it's interesting like that, you know, Arcand is kind of playing a little bit with that archetype. You know, this guy is essentially like a huge hypocrite. So I would have liked to have seen a little bit more texture there, but I was right. impressed. I think the performance wise, I think the actor, I forget the name of the actor, but I thought he was doing some textured work there and trying to like make him a fully rounded character, not just this like satirical, you know, mouthpiece.
Right. But yeah, to my point again there about,
sorry, did I get lost?
No, it's all good. I'm just trying to bring it back to
yeah.
Some other ideas that I had going around in my head. So the the allegory between the life of Jesus and kind of the life of a performer, so to speak, and that being kind of perhaps disrespectful in some way of, you know, who Jesus was and what he means. And like I say, I have just very vague understandings of these things, but it still kind of stuck out to me.
Yeah.
And I think it just feels vain in a way too, because even if there is value in that allegory, the only real value of it is to say that, like, you know, acting is this supreme, you know, form of work that you could take in your life, and that you have to make all these sacrifices, and you know that the society as a whole doesn't appreciate it and only tries to break it down or take advantage of it or turn it into this monetized thing and not really appreciate it. And I guess like there's value in exploring those ideas, but does it need to be explored in contrast to the life of Jesus?
I think there is value in doing that, because like the life of Jesus, you know, is this kind of universally recognized story of, even if you don't believe in, for those who don't believe in the divinity of Christ, like there's still many people who.
Wait, and so when you say that, you mean.
Respect his, like, you know, his.
Divinity. When you say divinity, you mean his ability to perform miracles, or like, I don't know.
Yeah. Like, means. Well, his nature as the second person of the Holy Trinity, his nature as the Son of God. So like eternally united to God, the Father and the Holy Spirit, Jesus, and, you know, is God in human flesh. So we believe that every moment he was on earth, he was still beholding, you know, God the Father in heaven, you know, even as he was with us on earth, he was never severed from that.
Yeah. So even if people don't believe in that,
they can still respect his, you know, the visible, attributes of his human ministry as recorded in the Gospels, you know, the championing the poor, healing, well, I guess it depends if you believe in the healing or not, but kind of like his fighting for the little guy, you know. One very popular, of course, there's this kind of misconception that Jesus was a religious revolutionary who was out to essentially you know, like he was a kind of like a, he was out to dismantle the structures, you know, which he explicitly, at least according to the Gospels, explicitly denies and says, I'm not here to destroy. I'm here to fulfill the law, the Jewish law, which he did perfectly. Anyway, so what I'm trying to, with the element of performing, I guess what I'm saying is, even if you don't believe in his divinity, there's still this understanding that if you know, that he was a good guy and that, you know, he gave his life for others, he gave his life to help others.
Right.
And so there's this purity there that, that, you know, you can kind of measure if that is a form of performance, you know, then for an, I don't know, it's kind of like a litmus test in some ways, like for an actor to challenge, like, cause I think a lot of actors would find it challenging to play. It's kind of a conundrum of trying to play saintly characters, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly because, like, the idea that, oh, they're not flawed, so it's very difficult to portray them or to write them or stuff like that, which I think is a bit of a fallacy because I think that speaks more to, like, a culture's inability to understand, like, holiness or sanctity or goodness, you know, and the ways in which that manifests in someone, including their internal struggles that are not external. But it is a challenge. I imagine most actors would have a challenge trying to get themselves into a headspace where they're playing a character who is very pure and good. And the thing about the Daniel Colombe in the film, and I think it's a beautiful performance, actually. I think L'Affaire Blotteau is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible in the role. Really one of the great Canadian male performances that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to hear your take on sort of like that. It's comparing this sort of idea that it's drawing this comparison of like vanity to like Jesus. I think that might be there, but for me, what was actually much more emphasized watching it as a believer was, you know, there's a sacramental aspect to the profession of the actor.
Yeah.
And to all the arts, essentially, you know, where I'm coming from as a filmmaker, you know, I make films because it allows me to kind of take what I'm receiving from my relationship with God, with other people and with the world, and to transfigure that into something that I can offer back to others. Mm-hmm. And that is the role of any artist, regardless of your medium. And for the actor, you know, and so I, you know, when I say like sacramental, like in the sense that the sacraments that the church provides for people, things like Holy Communion, confession, baptism, you know, these are these very specific kind of forms of receiving grace. But there's other things that's just the kind of at the top. There's other things that flow from that, you know, that the whole world being infused with the energy and love of God, the whole world in a certain sense is sacramental, and that it contains the potential and it's held together by the presence and the love of God. And so any matter, anything really, you know, fashioned towards drawing us towards the good, towards what is good and what is true, mm-hmm. and what is beautiful, that takes on this sort of sacramental quality. Essentially it draws us deeper in, it gives us a grace in a certain sense that draws us deeper into relationship with God and with each other, even if we don't articulate it that way, or we don't experience it that specifically. So the actor, you know, they are kind of placed in this role, like they are mediating something outside of them, mm-hmm. this inspiration. They're drawing from that, and then they are adding to that their own experience. That inspiration, you know, mediated through them, then goes to the audience, just like any other art form. But there's this very particular human element for the actor, of course. And I love how the film does go with that idea of like his portrayal, like him trying to get himself into the place of playing Jesus, does kind of sacramentally transform him into this Christ-like person.
Yeah, figure. But although again, like I feel like the way that manifests itself by the end of the film, when he has been like the guy tackles the security guard and knocks him off the mm-hmm. cross, and it, like that sort of carries him toward his eventual death.
Yeah.
Him being in that mind state and going and wandering through the subway station and just kind of speaking these words, which I presume are from the Bible.
I actually can't remember what he says. I think, yeah, I think,
like,
I'm pretty sure,
like,
it is.
He's like, yeah, don't walk down the road, or I can't,
yeah,
remember specifically.
I think he must have been.
They seemed phrased in such a way that they, yeah, they felt like they were from the Bible. So he's just kind of going up to people and giving them these words of advice. But because he's in this state that's, mm-hmm, that's resulted out of some clear brain trauma, mm, it felt like it was kind of saying, like, oh, well, you know, these prophets are only considered as such because, like, they're just crazy, or
yeah,
or that their connection to God, I guess just their connection to God is really only there because of some mental instability, or mm-hmm, like that's the feeling that I got from it.
Okay, yeah.
As opposed to him really transforming into that person.
Yeah. Well, of course he hasn't literally transformed into that person, but, yeah, but it's interesting. And this maybe this is the genius of the film, and that it plays itself down the middle, you know,
right,
enough that, regardless, your viewpoint kind of determines how you read that. I felt like I wasn't getting enough signals from kind of how it was treating him. I felt like the film was respectful of, like, basically saying there is a mystery here, mm-hmm, that we can't quite explain.
Right.
But then at the same time, I can totally see what you mean about, yeah, you could sort of just pass it off as he got hit in the head and now he's delusional and,
yeah,
so on and so forth. I don't think the film does take that tack in that. I think, like, because you see him transforming kind of throughout the film. He's gathering his disciples. He's gathering the cast of the play. He's calling them out of there. You know, there's all that kind of stuff where he's grabbing Mary Magdalene. He's grabbing Peter and stuff like that.
Right.
But you sort of see, I guess it's the scene where he flips the table, you know, when the Mary Magdalene character, is the other actress, is being asked to disrobe for an audition. He's, yeah, watching and he's incensed at sort of the lack of dignity shown to her, and she refuses. And so he ends up flipping the table with all the camera equipment and everything. And that's, of course, an allusion to Jesus flipping the tables in the temple.
Okay.
He flipped over the tables of the money changers, people who are selling, you know, changing money and selling the various sacrificial animals. And there's this market in the temple court. So he went in there and he flipped the tables and caused a ruckus and said, get out of here. This is my father's house.
Right.
But you sort of see in that moment, that to me, that is the turning point, you know, I think very obviously from sort of a biblical perspective of, okay, he is starting, something has shifted. He is, he's now starting to, like, become Jesus.
Right.
In how he's approaching things, his sense of justice, when it's aggrieved, he's behaving like Jesus. Other people are kind of subconsciously treating him like that, like with the lawyer tempting him with all these book deals and things like that. I think the film does lay the groundwork so that it's not just bonk and then now he's just,
right,
he's off, right?
Right,
like,
right,
I think,
right,
it is, it does start fairly early.
And I guess, and perhaps that's just more due to my own ignorance of not really knowing what those earlier scenes were alluding to in, mm, the Bible, to really see how that progression takes full form by the end. But one thing I did want to touch on, not related to, or I guess it's related, but in a lot of recent stories that are set during that time,
mm-hmm,
there's been a lot of criticism on the internet or
sorry,
elsewhere.
Set during the early
just
first century?
Or? Yeah, just set
yeah,
a couple thousand years ago of,
yeah,
of white actors,
mm-hmm,
playing the roles of these people. And obviously in this, I guess in this film, the Passion Play, I mean, you've got Jesus, but I don't know what the other characters are, who they're meant to be in the Passion Play, but...
Well, they play different characters,
yeah,
within, but the primary archetypes are Mary Magdalene, I believe Saint Peter is one of them, and the other one is the Mother of God.
Right.
So
they're all played by white actors.
Yeah.
I guess you would have more insight into this in terms of what ethnicity Jesus actually was, mm-hmm, or how that should be portrayed, but I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
Well, in this, I mean, the film essentially, this isn't an issue in the film, as far as I'm concerned, because, well, one, like, yeah, obviously Jesus was Jewish. He was Hebrew, and his family was, like, you know, his Mary would have been Hebrew. So his bloodline, and, you know, scripture records his bloodline descending from, you know, King David and so on. So there's no question there.
And Hebrew meaning,
like,
how does that relate to like what white people are? I don't know.
In terms of like color, you mean,
just in general, like how would he be?
Well, like we'd say like Middle Eastern,
yeah,
like Israeli, right?
Yeah,
like, you know, so yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people from different backgrounds can sort of, I think, pass off as that. But in the case of, it's not an issue in the film though, because the film is not really, again, the film's not trying to be a historical recreation or anything like that.
Right.
It's essentially, it's keeping itself grounded in the present day of 1989. Because passion plays, you know, are something that are all over the world, right?
Right.
And some examples are more famous than others. Some plays are more elaborate than others, but right. It is something that is all over the world, wherever their Catholicism is, essentially. It's a way for the people, it's the local people to sort of relive and recount what happened in a more visceral way and to let that aid their prayer.
Yeah.
So it's meant, you know, to be enculturated as far as any culture, you know, this story is for everyone. It's
right.
not for white people only, or for people of Israeli background only. Like, you know, the first disciples of Christ, like, you know, they were persecuted by the Jewish authorities, so they took the message of the gospel to Rome and to Greece and to the Gentiles, and so, you know, that's how Christianity spread originally.
Right.
So, like, it's for the whole world, you know. And in that case, the stories that we pass on, the history that we pass on, you know, every culture, every generation has to is free to retell those stories, with kind of the flourishes of their local customs, or, you know, obviously there's things you can't change, you know, because
yeah.
We're talking about a historical story. But yeah, like, as far as it's meant for any race to perform, essentially.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No. And so, I think that is a good distinction that those other films, and I can't think of any in particular, but
right.
There was, I think, Werner Herzog made one recently.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. That had like,
well, there's the
Twilight guy. What's his name?
Oh, I don't know.
really? Robert Pattinson. Yeah. He made,
really?
He made a movie set in ancient Egypt with Robert Pattinson. And I think,
okay.
Maybe
I think you're I thinking of he plays Lawrence of Arabia.
It could be, yeah.
That might have been it,
but and I'm not thinking specifically of religious stories, but
yeah.
I
know the one you're thinking of. It's the one with Ewan McGregor,
yeah.
as Jesus.
Okay, right? There's that.
Last Days in the Desert.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I feel like there have been a few of those, and
yeah.
those have received a lot of criticism. But given that they are actually set during that time,
yeah.
it makes more sense that they should be more cognizant
yeah.
of some sort of,
because they are trying to be a historical
yeah.
accurate place and time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one thing that did kind of stick out as just very racially insensitive and not something that I would want to see in, you know, a 2017 version of this
yes,
movie was yeah. when they, when the priest is getting them to kind of go back to the original, script for the passion play.
Mm-hmm.
And the two guys are like, oh, like, what if we do a Japanese version?
Oh,
and
I know.
Like,
yeah.
And the one actor actually like pulls her eyes to like,
yeah.
to like slant her eyes. And it's like,
so ooh. what happens is, for you guys listening, basically they go through this pantomime of different, the actors are putting on this joke about doing a number of different theater school techniques to like, and they're using it to mock the priest. So they basically take the script that he gave them, which is this very pious traditional kind of, it's not a, it's this very pious traditional script. It's kind of stuffy. And they say, let's apply Stanislavski to this. And they try to do like a Brando style,
thing,
which is actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
But then they also say, let's do a Go theater version, you know, or maybe it was
Kabuki.
They do a
yeah.
Kabuki version.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's one of those things, like the joke that they're trying to make is like, really it's they're making fun of the priest and
yeah.
it's not, but it is one of those jarring things where you're like, wow, okay, yeah, this probably wouldn't happen today, because they go through this whole elaborate pantomime of, you know, of a Kabuki play,
yeah,
which just feels very ignorant.
Yeah. But, you know, just 30 years old, that kind of stuff happened then. And it certainly could happen today and probably in an Adam Sandler movie or something like that. But
in some ways, I feel like that is one of those things that maybe is more likely to come from Quebec. And when I was talking earlier about that kind of old world influence.
Right.
I feel like that, you know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see that kind of gag show up in like a French thing.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if that, you know, yeah, maybe not, certainly not politically correct. But I wonder if that has more roots in kind of like a more European and continental kind of like, I don't know, sense of self versus the other that English Canada, I think, is shedding or has begun to shed. I don't know.
Yeah. Hard to say. I think that's probably a good point to wrap it up for Jesus in Montreal.
Can I make one more comment?
Yes.
The thing that for me, I stress that I take away from the film is that, and maybe we'll talk more about this when we talk about other subjects, but the intersection of sort of this sort of spiritual religious topic with cinema, you know, again, that's something that's very close to what I'm interested in. And I find it very interesting that Canadian cinema does not have its own tradition per se of this, you know, what you could loosely call like transcendental cinema, you know, that term that Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver and all that, he before he did that, he wrote this thesis on, you know, on the films of Ozu and Bresson and Dreyer and he called it transcendental cinema. And even, you know, we could debate that all day as far as like whether he was on point with that or not, but it's interesting that some cultures do kind of produce these more meditative films.
Or like Tarkovsky.
Yeah, Tarkovsky he wasn't like famous enough at that point for Schrader, but his films are different too, though, from what he was going after. But yeah, Tarkovsky, Malick, you know, like people I would say are like, they're very contemplative in different ways, and that doesn't necessarily mean slow cinema. It doesn't mean holding a shot for 5 minutes. Yeah, you know, they're contemplative.
Malick's recent work is probably got more cuts in it than
the entirety of Stalker or like one. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, for me as a Canadian filmmaker, what I'm really interested in is like, how does Canadian, you know, my identity as a Canadian filmmaker and other people's identity as Canadian artists, you know, why is it that we don't really have this established tradition of sort of a more spiritually aware, a more meditative, contemplative tradition of cinema? Mm-hmm. And so Jesus in Montreal was an attempt for me to sort of like, okay, well, here's a point where it very obviously crosses paths with the art form. Let's see how they handle it. And I guess the result that I saw, you know, I like the film. I think it's very well done, but it was disappointing to me in that it does, like I was saying earlier, it's very prosaic. It's very like it's mostly just satire.
Yeah.
It remains outside of the purview of possibility of mystery in the end, you know, even though it kind of entertains it at certain points, the mystery of what is happening to these characters, it ultimately, I think, stays safely outside of that. In a way that other filmmakers from different cultures outside of Canada would have been open to something more, you know, religiously, you could say dangerous or maybe not dangerous, but open to mystery.
Sure.
To the numinous. And so, yeah, that's what I found most interesting about it. How do we as a culture, even a culture that has this deep religious history like Quebec, how does it grapple with these things? And the results were they were not what I expected per se. Well, they kind of were, but then it was still even more than what I expected.
Right.
So, yeah.
We have an arbitrary and made up rating system on the podcast that
I love them. I love arbitrary stuff.
That fluctuates and does not stay consistent. It is based on a number of leafs out of another number of leafs.
Okay.
I've typically gone up in sequence of prime numbers, but I've gotten to the point where I can't remember what the last prime number we did was.
Okay. It's like Calvin Ball, kind of.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, you know, Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh.
But they score. It's a game he makes up. And
They
it's like the score is like Q to 3.
That's great. I haven't read any Calvin and Hobbes really in cool. years, but yeah. I should go back and read some of that stuff. But so let's just say this one's out of 101 leafs.
Okay.
What would you give Jesus of Montreal?
I think I would give it, well, I have to convert everything to my Letterboxd star rating. I gave it 3.5 stars on Letterboxd. So right. I think that would translate to like maybe
70.5 leaves.
You know, I'm going to say like 67 leaves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. I am going to, you know, respect the Quebecois cultural heritage of the movie and give it 70 fleur-de-lis. Out of 101 leaves. And it really has no bearing on what I actually think of the movie, but I get the sense that you are more precise in your ratings and do actually have some sense of what those mean to
I'm
you.
Not, but I'm not like Mike D'Angelo precise, but I feel like I kind of was there now. I felt like that 67 just seemed like the right number.
Nice.
But I generally try not to think of it in those terms.
Nice. Yeah, so that is Jesus of Montreal, and we will have Nathan back on for another episode to talk about some of his short films and other topics surrounding the concept of Canadian cinema. But for now, maybe if people don't get a chance to listen to that other episode, maybe if you can let people know where you can find your stuff on the internets, where you're on Twitter, all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, for sure. So I'm on Twitter at N.W. Douglas. That's N as in Nathan, W as in William, at N.W. Douglas. And my website is stoneridgefilms.com. I might be changing that up soon. The same link, N.W. Douglas.com, will get you there too.
Okay.
And there's info. I'm on Vimeo. You can find links there. It's all over
cool.
the place. Instagram. So.
Good stuff. And we are at www.filmedincanada.net. And you can email us at filmedincanada@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter at Married2AFly, but not really tweeting much these days.
Will I get to meet the fly today?
I can show you some of my old comics, which is what that's based off of. But the fly does not exist in reality. That is all for now, and we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.